last investigator I chatted with was Dr. Nathan Fowler, who over the last couple of years has been reporting on one of the most interesting new therapies in lymphoma, namely the non-chemotherapy regimen now known as R-squared, lenalidomide and rituximab. To begin, I asked Dr. Fowler what his vision is of the mechanism of anti-tumor action of lenalidomide and why it seems so synergistic with rituximab.
I think the mechanism is still under debate. That's the official answer. But there's some nice work coming from England and some centers in the United States that suggests that lenalidomide may be kind of repairing this immune recognition of cancer cells in the microenvironment. So whether that's in the lymph node or in the bone marrow, there's some data that lenalidomide in preclinical models increases ADCC. So the idea was if you combine it with a monoclonal antibody like rituximab, which, you know, potentially uses ADCC as its main mechanism, you use a drug like lenalidomide to kind of boost that effect or kind of modulate what's happening in the immune microenvironment. Now, how that works, you know, in a finer detail, it's not quite clear what's happening within the cell. But in the microenvironment, it's pretty clear that lenalidomide changes the way T cells and NK cells act.
You know, it's interesting because in myeloma, of course, that's been debated a lot, but now we're starting to see lenalidomide and elotuzumab. And I was wondering whether it's been looked at with other monoclonal antibodies that work through ADCC, including trastuzumab.
So the short answer is no. There is a study ongoing in France where they're looking at lenalidomide plus GA101, which is a kind of next generation anti-CD20. And this drug has been billed as a drug which has increased ADCC. So it would make sense if this has increased ADCC compared to rituximab, then using lenalidomide with that drug would be something that could be interesting.
And now we're seeing some really interesting data on GA101, now known as obinutuzumab in CLL. And it could be that this anti-CD20 agent may end up replacing rituximab, at least in CLL. But we'll have to see how the big phase 3 data set evolves. Anything you want to say about that?
Well, it's a glycosylated molecule, which means it has a flexible elbow. And supposedly, this change in the way this is constructed allows tighter binding or increased binding to immune effector cells like NK cells and T cells. From what I've seen in the preclinical data, it also has increased direct cell death when compared to rituximab. Now, how that works, I don't really understand why it appears to kill cells better in the lab than rituximab. This is without any immune system present. But for at least, again, from my understanding as a clinician, due to this kind of change in structure, it allows increased ADCC compared to rituximab.
Let's get back to R-squared. What was the background of studying this combination?
So I guess about 4 years ago, some folks around the country, including people at my center, were looking at what would happen if you combine lenalidomide and rituximab in the lab. And so we did some studies combining lenalidomide with rituximab in mantle cell lines and in mouse models. And it looked like the combination worked better than either agent alone. About the same time, there was, again, data coming out from London and other groups showing that you could repair an immune synapse, or there was, again, this repaired recognition of tumor by immune cells. So we initially launched a pilot study. It was 30 patients in indolent lymphoma. These are untreated patients now. They've never had any chemotherapy or rituximab. And in the study, very early on, we saw a really strong signal in follicular lymphoma. In fact, when we first presented the data, I think about 3 years ago, we had 100% CR in follicular lymphoma. So obviously this was something that we paid attention to, and we expanded the study to enroll 110 patients. And because we were obviously very interested in what was happening in follicular, the study was weighted to enroll patients with follicular lymphoma. So we enrolled 50 patients with follicular, 30 SLL, and 30 marginal zone lymphomas. So we presented that data now, and although it's not 100%, the complete response rate in the follicular lymphoma patients is around 87%. So we're excited, and that was the basis of the recently launched randomized study called RELEVANCE, which stands for, I think it's lenalidomide versus any chemotherapy. So the patient is randomized to receive this R-squared or R-chemo, and doctors can pick between R-CHOP, R-CVP, or R-bendamustine. So we're hoping, you know, that this kind of biologic treatment of an immune modulator and antibody is better than any of the three kind of standard chemotherapies which are commonly used.
What's the current status of accrual of that study?
Good question. So I think as of last month, we're around 300 patients out of the planned 1,000. So about a third of the way accrued, and it's been open about a year and a half. So,
and I'm kind of curious, what kind of chemo are people using in the chemo arm?
Sure. Good question. I don't know. Because it's a registration study, and even though I'm kind of the lead here in the United States, I don't have access to the data.
Any speculation on what you think is going on? We have some data ourselves in terms of patterns of care right now in the United States, for example, in terms of upfront our chemo regimens and FL. What do you think is going on, and what are you doing outside of trial setting?
Sure. Good question, too. So I think with the results of the STEEL study, which was the study where they were basically the Germans took newly diagnosed mantle cell lymphoma and low-grade lymphomas and randomized them to receive either R-CHOP or bendamustine and rituximab. And in this fairly large randomized study, bendamustine and rituximab, the progression-free survival was dramatically longer than R-CHOP, and there appeared to be less myelosuppression. Yeah, that study was announced a couple years ago and it was recently published in Lancet. But based upon those results, I think we've seen a really rapid paradigm shift in the way people treat newly diagnosed follicular lymphoma. And my impression from seeing patients that are referred in to me from the community as well as with my colleagues, bendamustine or rituximab has kind of replaced R-CHOP as the new standard for patients with indolent disease. You could argue that we need validation studies. One of those was recently completed. But I think a lot of the community has accepted that bendamustine or rituximab is a very reasonable alternative to R-CHOP without a lot of the toxicity that we see with R-CHOP.
How about your own practice?
So in my practice, I do use bendamustine or rituximab as my frontline option for low-grade follicular. And I think that's important to clarify. In patients who there's a suggestion of transformation, or there's any grade 3 component, I still do R-CHOP. I think that there's not enough data that in higher grade lymphomas that bendamustine or rituximab is equivalent.
And there were data presented at ASH, the so-called BRIGHT study, looking at BR. Can you comment on that?
So the BRIGHT study was really just preliminary results that were recently presented. So we don't have progression-free survival data. I think that's what a lot of people would like to see. What I get out of the BRIGHT study, at least what we've seen so far, is that it looks about the same as R-CHOP. The complete response rates, overall response rates in low-grade lymphomas look pretty similar to R-CHOP. Now, in the previous German study, the complete response rates were better in the BR arm, but at least in the BRIGHT study, it looks equivalent. The BRIGHT study, the design was slightly different. They used RCVP and R-CHOP, and so that may account for the kind of slightly lower CR rate. But at least from the data I've seen, the BRIGHT study would suggest that BR is no worse. I don't think that it necessarily tells us it's better yet.
It's always hard to look at toxicity data in trials and kind of really figure out what it means, because there you couldn't really distinguish, I don't think, a big toxicity difference. But from the point of view of quality of life, from your own observation, do you think that BR is better tolerated?
So in my practice, I think there's no question. I think BR is absolutely better tolerated in patients. If you see folks, I have several patients, you know, many of these patients are in the prime of their life. You know, they have a job and kids, and many of these folks are able to continue working full-time. And although they come in monthly for their BR, many times there's not a lot of toxicity. And that's not what we commonly see with CHOP. Patients know they're on chemotherapy. There's a lot of fatigue. Obviously, although it's not something that maybe affects their performance status, but hair loss is something patients really pay attention to. And they know they're on chemotherapy when they lose the hair. And I think we sometimes minimize that. But I think that in general, most patients tolerate bendamustine better than R-CHOP.
Getting back to the R-squared regimen, what do we know about this in CLL, mantle cell, and other lymphomas?
So in CLL, there is activity. My group, along with some folks in New York, have been doing the similar R-squared regimen in patients with relapsed CLL. And in those folks, the response rates are not as high, and the progression-free survival appears to be shorter. We're not quite clear why CLL patients, and in our study, the SLL patients also had the lowest response rate and the shortest progression-free survival. There is, you know, the decreased density of CD20 on the surface of CLL and SLL cells compared to follicular, which may account for, you know, why we're not seeing the same effect with the combination with an antibody like rituximab. I think my gestalt is there's also, you know, changes in the microenvironment in follicular that we don't see in some of the other histologies. We're still kind of trying to tease that out, why we just see such a robust response in follicular and we don't really see it in some of the other indolent histologies. With mantle, as far as I know, there is no upfront study with R-squared in mantle. In relapsed disease, the response rate is also not quite as high as we see in follicular, and I think it's around 50-odd percent.
If we're a patient with follicular lymphoma, and I don't know whether you faced that in your own practice, it's interesting, you know, talking to a patient about going in a trial that randomizes them between, you know, chemo or not. Those kinds of trials in any cancer are always interesting, and I can imagine there might be patients, educated patients, physicians as patients, et cetera, who might say, well, how about using that off study?
Sure.
How do you feel about that?
I think that, you know, despite the phase two data, I would not recommend using it off study, especially not in the frontline setting. I think that we're still kind of learning some of the adverse events that could occur with the regimen in a newly diagnosed population with a disease that has good treatment options. I would be very hesitant to use something that has not been validated in a randomized study to be better than chemo or safer than chemo. You know, my sense is that we're not going to see a lot of toxicity, but that's the purpose of a randomized study, and I personally would not recommend it, and I don't use it off-label.
So lenalidomide was just approved in mantle cell lymphoma. What's your experience with it there, and for that matter, in diffuse large B-cell?
I can tell you from my own experience and some of my colleagues, it does have very nice activity in relapsed mantle, relapsed follicular, and relapsed large cell lymphomas. Some of these patients have burned through prior chemotherapy, sometimes autologous stem cell transplant. Often the performance status is not what we would need for chemotherapy. And in those patients, I think it's a great option. I personally have had large cell lymphoma patients who have failed multiple lines of treatment, and kind of as a, you know, Hail Mary, I'll put them on lenalidomide, and I've seen complete responses. So I think in that population, again, these folks that have kind of failed your traditional chemotherapies, I think lenalidomide is a very good option. I would be hesitant to, you know, recommend it as early in the salvage course because there are still things that work, but I think we're going to see its use in the salvage setting, but we still need those trials to confirm.
Any comments on the idea or the research concept, really, of moving it up front in large cell, the so-called R-squared CHOP regimen?
Yeah, I think we have to be careful, at least in large cell lymphoma. You know, you've got a regimen that is very active in the majority of patients. So you've got a curative, it's kind of like the same philosophy that we use for Hodgkin's. I think that we always have to be very careful about adding any new agent to a regimen that's potentially curative in a group of patients. Because what you don't want to do, obviously, is decrease the efficacy or decrease the dose of your active drugs by adding another drug. Although I think lenalidomide is fairly well tolerated in most patients, we know from other experiences that adding it to chemotherapy can sometimes be toxic. There was a recently presented study from Northern Europe where when they added it to bendamustine, there was a lot of toxicity. And this is not something we would have expected, but the rash appeared to be worse when you added it to bendamustine. There was some more myelosuppression. So I think that at least for now, I think we need these toxicity studies to show us that it's safe. I would absolutely not recommend doing that outside of a clinical trial.
So, and I guess the other thing is a question of whether or not it works better in, you know, ABC subtype.
That's a great question. And there was kind of a meta-analysis from patients that received lenalidomide for relapse disease as part of phase two studies in large cell lymphoma. And that study suggested that patients with ABC large cell lymphoma had dramatically better responses in germinal center. This is a single agent lenalidomide. Now, to counter that, when we've looked at patients with large cell lymphoma from other studies, it looks like germinal center or transformed follicular lymphomas tend to respond better than de novo large cell. And those are obviously GC cancers. So I think it's kind of, I'm not sure we know which subtype would respond better to lenalidomide.
So in addition to the excitement about R-squared, there's a lot of interest in the new B-cell receptor small molecule inhibitors, particularly the PI3 kinase delta inhibitor, adelalisib, and the Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitor, ibrutinib. And you've done some work in this area too. Any comments on these agents?
So these things are very, very exciting. And when I think of new drugs that are out there that have the potential to really change the way we treat non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or B-cell cancers. I mean, in addition to these immunomodulatory drugs like lenalidomide, the drugs that are being developed blocking the B-cell receptor pathway are extremely interesting, mainly because they appear to have activity across B-cell cancers. Several of these drugs are very selective, and they only hit kinases which are present in B-cells, which means there's not a lot of off-target toxicity. With the ibrutinib, we ran the phase 1 study. It's been now about 2 to 3 years now we've presented that. And we saw responses in mantle cell lymphoma. This is in relapsed mantle cell lymphoma, almost 80% response rate, including patients that had failed transplant, failed hyper-CVAD, failed ICE, and relapsed CLL. We saw responses also close to 70%. In follicular lymphoma, about half of the patients were responding. And although that was exciting, I think even more exciting is that ASH, 6 months ago, the results of several kind of validation studies, several phase 2 studies, some of these with up to 100 patients, confirmed those responses. And mantle cell lymphoma, we're seeing responses on the order of 70-80%. CLL, including 17p deletion, which, as you know, does very poor with traditional chemotherapy. Very high responses, including progression-free survival at 2 years of almost 60% in relapsed CLL with 17p deletion. So, at least in my opinion, these drugs appear to hit a key pathway in the B cell that several malignant clones require for survival. Although I think alone these drugs are probably not going to cure most patients, they really add to the arsenal of things that we can use for patients with B-cell cancers. And again, the great thing is that these drugs are fairly non-toxic. So if you think about how rituximab changed the way we treat B-cell cancers, these drugs have the potential to have that magnitude of effect. So what I see happening in the future is we're going to get ibrutinib or idelalisib plus R-CHOP or plus BR or plus CVP plus fludarabine, because the drugs don't appear to cause additive toxicity.
Any interest in combining the two drugs?
Absolutely. Yes, I think that would be, for me as a guy who develops new regimens, I think the holy grail would be designing something like CHOP, except instead of, you know, prednisone plus a couple chemotherapy drugs, we'd have maybe a newer generation anti-CD20 combined with a PI3 kinase inhibitor, a Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and maybe a BCL2 inhibitor. So, you know, combining multiple new biologics that hit different pathways in the cell, I think is the way we could potentially cure this disease.
And I guess as your former attending Bruce Chesson has been talking about a world without chemo and B-cell neoplasia, do you think that might happen?
I do, yeah. I absolutely do. I think that, and I had this question from the audience when I was presenting. I think today, I don't want to overplay or overstate the significance of these drugs. As I mentioned, most patients, at least with these drugs as single agents, are not getting complete remission. Many patients are still progressing well on these new drugs. So I don't think we understand the resistance pathways, and we don't understand how to combine them. So at least for today, we need chemo, and we need chemo for pretty much every patient still with lymphoma. I'm hopeful that as we get a little smarter and figure out how to combine these, that, you know, we're going to see chemotherapy go away, and I hope that that happens in my career. But I think that we're still several years out from moving to a non-chemo approach. But the great news is, you know, after decades of searching for the right drugs, I think we're finally there. We have the tools now. Now we just kind of have to figure out how to use those tools to take care of these cancers.
I want to get into your cases in a second, but first I want to ask you about a paper you published, and something I've been asking people about intermittently over the years, on the use of ras-burocase in terms of preventing tumor lysis syndrome. Can you comment on that?
So it's also a very good drug. I think that compared to what we were using before for patients with high tumor burden, allopurinol, ras-burocase has almost eliminated tumor lysis. I mean, it's quite rare now using ras-burocase in patients, for example, with Burkitt's or high-risk large cell lymphoma to develop significant tumor lysis leading to renal failure or hemodynamic instability. And we do still see bumps in the LDH. Occasionally, the uric acid will go up, even on ras-burocase. But the old days where tumor lysis put patients in the ICU, I really rarely see it.
Any situations where you think about this outside the traditional, and specifically in terms of CLL and lenalidomide?
One thing about lenalidomide, we see, at least in the low-grade lymphomas, it tends to work a little slower than traditional chemotherapy. So we haven't seen any tumor lysis, even in bulky disease, in follicular. Now, in CLL, SLL, there is this phenomenon called tumor flare, where patients' white count will often go up. The lymph node gets big. I mean, I think this is probably kind of an immune reaction that's occurring in the nodal sites or the sites of disease. So it's a little different than tumor lysis. It's more of a kind of a, the immune system gets activated and begins attacking the sites of lymphoma, leukemia. So in those cases, I don't know if drugs like allopurinol and respiracase would prevent it. In the past, we use pulse steroids when patients get this kind of tumor flare or tumor lysis syndrome. But I think the mechanism is a little different than what we see with something like R-CHOP or RICE chemotherapy.
Let's talk about your cases. What about your 52-year-old man? No significant comorbidities, pain in the left flank, night sweats, 10-pound weight loss, CT shows bulky retroperitoneal adenopathy, multiple nodal stations above and below the diaphragm, and he's got follicular lymphoma on biopsy. 20% of the node is grade 3B, 80% grade 1, 2, Q67, 50%.
Yes. So this is actually a gentleman that I saw fairly recently. We presented him in our multidisciplinary conference because of this composite lymphoma. And I picked this case because this is similar to cases that I often get referrals for. And again, I wanted to kind of highlight, when you see a patient with what we call a composite lymphoma, that's a lymphoma where there's a small high-grade component as well as a grade 1, 2 follicular, I always treat the high-grade component. So this is not a patient that I think would be a good candidate for something like bendamustine rituximab or even RCVP. So this gentleman, I gave R-CHOP and he had a complete remission. But I think in these cases, even if it's, you know, 10% of the disease has a grade 3 component, that we need to treat them as we would a garden variety large cell lymphoma. And I think R-CHOP would be my recommendation.
Any situations where you kind of get that feel clinically, but you really don't see it under the microscope?
So I do. And that's, though this is something we debate, the use of PET scans, I often will get a PET scan at initial staging in patients with follicular lymphoma, especially patients where I suspect something is going on. They present with a clinical history that's not consistent with follicular, they've got rapidly growing nodes, or they'll have a kind of a bulky disease or a disease that's invading extranodal organs. In those cases, I'll get a PET. And if the PET SUV is high, and I don't mean 9 or 10, but if the SUV is 25 or 30, even if my biopsy says grade 1, 2, I'll often treat with R-CHOP. As you know, and we all know, that these biopsies are often, you know, sometimes we can miss a transform component. Sometimes the pathologist, if you give it to two or three pathologists, you'll have disagreement. So I think that you still have to follow your nose, and if clinically the patient is behaving aggressively, I'll treat them like an aggressive lymphoma.
How about your 81-year-old lady who was found to have some nodes in her neck on physical exam but asymptomatic?
Sure. So there's a lot of debate about what to do with asymptomatic, low tumor burden, indolent patients, whether that's marginal zone or follicular lymphoma. You know, in the past, there have been several randomized studies in Europe which suggested that with observation or chemotherapy, the outcomes were about the same. So again, in several randomized studies, no benefit in survival to treating patients early. Now, the argument with against a lot of those studies is they used older chemotherapy, and if we had rituximab or had these, some of these newer drugs, we could affect survival. But I think that, you know, until I see those studies, especially in a randomized way, I still watch patients that don't have bulky disease, they don't have symptoms, and they don't have a threatened organ function. The way I kind of, when I talk to my patients about this, these studies show there's no difference in survival. This doesn't mean that everyone's dying of lymphoma. This means if I start treatment now, or I start treatment in 3 months, probably they're going to do okay. In these studies, also, there was a select group of patients, about 20%, who at 10 years in the observation arm still didn't require treatment. And because I don't know who those 20% are, and these studies suggest there's no danger in waiting, I generally give patients the benefit of the doubt and say, let's just repeat scans in 3 to 6 months. If this thing is not growing, I'll continue to watch them until there's some evidence to start treatment.
So if you have a patient like this one who you look at and you go, well, Yeah, I guess I could probably get her through BR, but I wouldn't be necessarily that happy about doing that. Then the question comes up about R alone.
Yeah.
In what situations, if any, do you use it? I've heard people talk about this type of patient to maybe delay or prevent having to receive chemo.
Sure. So if we just take a patient that's in their 80s and they're developing progressive disease, it's not quite bulky, there's no evidence of transformation, but you get the sense that you're going to need to start treatment in the near future, I think single agent rituximab is great for those folks. The complete response rate is low, but most patients will derive some benefit, meaning the nodes will shrink, and the average progression-free survival is, in most studies, around 2 years. So I do think you can delay treatment if you've got an older patient. I will often add additional dosing. You know, the Swiss have published data using 8 doses of rituximab instead of 4.
The SAC regimen?
Yeah, the SAC regimen. And I think that's a great option for kind of the non-chemo patients that you know, you're trying to delay them ever dying of lymphoma, essentially. And so if you can delay that for years, I think that's as good as getting a complete response.
So I see that this lady was observed for a year, but then comes back symptomatic with anemia, progression a little bit in her lymph nodes, and now the bone marrow, which before was 30% involved, now is 80%. Mm-hmm. What were you thinking at that point?
So there, I think that's when a detailed discussion with your patient comes into play. So this is a lady that I don't think there is a right answer here. I think that single agent rituximab, BR, or even RCVP would be good options for this lady. We'd have to discuss the side effects, the length of treatment, what her and her family would be willing to go through. I think, you know, if she was very healthy and didn't have any significant comorbidities, I probably would try bendamustine rituximab. I would not necessarily commit for 6 cycles, but we could try 1 or 2 cycles, see how she does, see if we can reduce the size of her tumors. And if she's not tolerating it, stop or give her single agent rituximab.
Well, how do you approach dosing in the 80-year-old?
So I would say my official recommendation is that most patients should get 90 milligrams per meter squared on day 1, day 2 of bendamustine. Now, even though I say that, there are elderly patients, especially patients who maybe have a hypocellular marrow, and I'll often start at 70 milligrams. But I think in the healthy patient who has a good bone marrow, I mean, the cellularity is 30, 40%, I generally start at 90 milligrams, but quickly reduce that to 70 if they have prolonged cytopenias or they have difficulty. So I usually try to start with 90.
What happened with this lady?
So she got single agent rituximab, actually. And she did very well. She's had a partial remission. She's now on maintenance rituximab, which I'm giving every 3 months.
For how long?
2 years.
Interesting. So she got, what was the initial?
I got 4 doses, so basically 1 dose weekly times 4. She went into a partial remission, and she's now getting maintenance rituximab. I think she's about to get her 2nd course.
Any complications or problems?
Hmm.
Have you seen any problems at all with rituximab maintenance?
I know that in the maintenance studies, they didn't report a lot of hypogammaglobulinemia, but I do see that. I have personally seen patients who are on rituximab maintenance who have low IgG and will come in with recurrent upper respiratory tract infections. Sometimes these infections persist for 4 to 6 weeks, and those patients usually benefit from IVIG. But that's probably the only consistent adverse event that I see is occasionally upper respiratory tract infections from low immunoglobulin levels.
How about your 62-year-old patient with a history of stage 3 low-grade follicular lymphoma in 2008? I see he got 6 cycles of BR at that point without any kind of maintenance. What happened?
Sure. So in 2008, he had 6 cycles of bendamustine rituximab, and he progressed recently.
So he went into a CR?
Went into CR with bendamustine rituximab and then progressed. So this is a patient that I think we're going to be seeing more and more in practice. And I kind of selected this case because now that the frontline regimen is beginning to shift to bendamustine rituximab, I think a lot of us, well, where do we go next? I think there are several options here, and we could maybe re-expose this patient to bendamustine and rituximab. We could do single agent rituximab. We could switch to another alkylator like CBP or R-CHOP.
Transplant?
We could do transplant. I think what I generally do in patients, especially if they have a prolonged remission with whatever the induction is, whether that's CVP, CHOP, bendamustine, I will often give them another line of salvage therapy and see how they do. If they've had bendamustine rituximab in the past, I'll often just give them single agent rituximab and see what kind of mileage I can get. If they again progress, I'll generally go to R-CHOP. Now, if after the first salvage regimen, they progress soon, and that means within about 12 to 18 months, I send them to transplant, especially if they're young. Because you know, most studies have suggested that if patients are beginning to progress quickly after the second and third line therapy, we're going to run into problems. And there's a big retrospective study from Britain that showed in patients on fourth line therapy, the median remission time is less than a year. So if you're getting to your fourth line and you've got a 45 or 50 year old, you're in trouble. And those are the patients that I would be sending to my transplanter. Now, you know, whether they get an auto transplant or allogeneic transplant, sometimes depends on the center and whether they have a match. But those are the folks that I think they need consolidation, because we're going to run out of options, and we're probably going to run out of options quickly.
Let's close out by talking a little bit more about mantle cell. We've talked a little bit about it, but I'm curious in terms of your clinical approach and what your thoughts are about some of the research trials that are going on. First, I'm curious about the issue of, we talked about watch and wait for follicular lymphoma. Sure. How does that come into play in mantle cell?
Sure. So, great questions. This is something that really has kind of emerged, I'd say, in the last 4 or 5 years, this concept of an indolent form of mantle cell lymphoma. And I think we're not quite clear how to describe that or how to determine who has the indolent variant. And I've kind of questioned folks when they get on the podium and speak about mantle cell lymphoma. I'll ask them, well, how do you define this indolent variant? Is this based on LDH? Is this Ki-67? Is this MIPI score? And no one seems to really have a good answer. And I think that's because we're still kind of learning exactly what this is. But I think it's pretty clear that around 20% of patients with newly diagnosed mantle cell lymphoma will not have this aggressive course and require intensive chemotherapy. And those are the folks you could probably watch and wait. In my practice, I often use Ki-67. So if the Ki-67 is less than about 15%, if they have a normal LDH, and if clinically they're not progressing, so if they come in and say, you know, I've noted this node, and it's been there for 6 months, it's not changing in size, those patients I'll often watch. But, you know, to be honest, it's kind of taking the whole thing together. You know, again, their staging studies, their labs, their pathology, and you begin to get a sense that maybe this is a slow-growing disease. But unfortunately, I don't have a good answer for you today. I'm hoping that some of my mantle cell colleagues will give us a scoring system so we can predict who's going to do good or bad. For the patients that have the more aggressive mantle cells, again, high Ki-67s, bulky disease, I still believe that intensive chemotherapy in the front line is the way to go. So in MD Anderson, we use hyper-CVAD. We don't generally do a transplant in these patients in the frontline setting. In elderly patients, I think bendamustine rituximab is a very good option if you don't think they're going to tolerate intensive therapy.
A couple practical questions. Do you, in a patient who doesn't have GI symptoms, do endoscopy upper and lower in patients with mantle cell?
We do. Yeah, we do. There's been some studies that suggest if you look hard enough, if you do upper and lower endoscopy, the vast majority of patients will have involvement in the colon. Now, again, you could argue, is that going to affect your treatment? Probably not, but I do think if patients finish treatment, it is informative to me to know if they're in a complete remission. So it's kind of like getting a bone marrow in a lot of these folks. Although it may not affect your treatment, it's a way to assess response at the end of therapy. So in other words, if patients have a positive colonoscopy or the biopsy is positive for mantle, I'll often repeat it after the therapy to make sure that they truly are in a complete remission. If they're not in a complete remission, those are patients that I'm thinking, you know, maybe they're going to need a transplant in the near future, or we might want to think about some sort of maintenance therapy.
How often do you see actual GI complications, obstruction, et cetera, in mantle cell?
In my practice, I would say probably less than 15 to 20%. The majority of patients, even if they have colon involvement, it's usually asymptomatic.
You mentioned hyper-CVAD or hyper-CVAD, and it kind of seems like the reported toxicity sort of outside of MD Anderson is a lot higher than within MD Anderson.
Sure.
How do you explain that?
Well, I think it's kind of the age-old argument that, you know, patients that are healthy enough to get on a plane and fly to Houston often have better performance status. In most studies, they're probably a little bit younger. They're probably a little bit healthier than some of the folks that are treated in the community. And I think that that's unfortunately a dilemma that we have when we interpret studies from a lot of the major cancer centers, is that the populations that are getting on these studies are usually healthier than we see at other sites. The flip side of that is in some of the relapsed studies, I think that we have sicker patients. Again, patients are coming to MD Anderson because they failed 2, 3, 4 lines of therapy. So I think in some of the early phase studies, the argument is actually the opposite, that we tend to get sicker patients. But at least for some of the standard of care studies, I do think some of it has to do with patient selection.
Any comments on the issue of rituximab maintenance in mantle cell?
Yeah. So I do think there is a benefit to maintenance. And there was a European study which was recently presented that showed a clear benefit following CHOP, I believe it was CHOP, of rituximab maintenance in mantle cell lymphoma. Whether you can make that leap to apply that to patients that had hyper-CVAD or BR, I think is at least unknown today. But at least in the non-intensive therapies, there appear to be a real benefit in progression-free survival with rituximab maintenance.